So we are halfway through the book of Ecclesiastes. And I do get the sense that some of you are thinking, oh, this book is so meaningless. And I just want to remind you that God does speak to us through his word. And this is written from the perspective of life on earth. And so far, in the six chapters before that, the preacher has shared with us his search for the meaning of life. And he's looked at the kind of cycle that creation and life has. He's looked at pleasures and money and agriculture and architecture, all to try and find the meaning of life. And these have been his sort of observations. He's concluded, as we know, that life under the sun is meaningless several times. And yet still, actually, when we look towards God, the preacher says actually things do feel different. And he's talked about friendship, and last week we heard a little bit about worship. And the remaining sort of six chapters from here on are a mixture of kind of proverbs and narration, where the preacher is trying to impart the wisdom of how best to live this life under the sun, how to make the most of life under the sun. And so we come to Ecclesiastes 7, and I'm just going to read the first 14 verses. So we're not even doing the whole of it, but we are doing half of Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Let me read it to you. I'm going to read from the screen just because the version in front of me is different. So here we go. A good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death better than the day of birth. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. For death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. Frustration is better than laughter, because a sad face is good for the heart. Stay with me. Stay with me here. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure. It is better to heed the rebuke of a wise person than to listen to the song of fools. Like the crackling of thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of fools. This too is meaningless. Extortion turns a wise person into a fool, and a bribe corrupts the heart. The end of a matter is better than its beginning, and patience is better than pride. Do not be quickly provoked in your spirit, for anger resides in the lap of fools. Do not say, why were the old days better than these? For it is not wise to ask such questions. Wisdom, like an inheritance, is a good thing and benefits those who see the sun. Wisdom is a shelter, as money is a shelter, but the advantage of knowledge is this: wisdom preserves those who have it. Consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked? When times are good, be happy. When times are bad, consider this: God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, no one can discover anything about the future. Well, if you would humour me just for a moment, some things in life are difficult. Who here can rub their tummy and pat their head? If you're a drummer, you should be able to do that. That's a fairly standard thing. Who here can lick their elbow? I love the fat Mark's even trying. Here's something you can all try. If you can cross your leg, just as Steve is doing here. And with the leg that is crossed, just make a small circle in a clockwise motion. And then with your finger, write an S like that, and you'll find your foot wants to go the other way. Give it a try. Isn't that weird? It's really difficult to move your foot in a clockwise direction and make an S with your leg crossed like that. If you can do it, then you're in a small percentage of the country who can do it. Can you do it, Adrian? If you really think about it. All right, I won't make you do anything like that now, but... That's good. Only a small percentage of the population could do that. What? Any other ear wigglers in? No. Can you touch your nose with your tongue? Anyone do that? Nearly. Or your chin with your tongue. That's even impressive as well. All right. There were loads of them, but we won't keep doing it. You see, chapter 7, the preacher here is talking about the value of the difficult stuff in life over the pleasant stuff. That's what's going on here. And the reality is that life is full of the difficult. As we get older, we realise that the youthfulness, when life was much easier, when, you know, your washing was being done for you, when your meals was being done, life suddenly becomes difficult. You get these meme things that come up on Facebook and things. The best meme I ever read was that moment when you're in a room and you're looking for the adult in the room, and then you realise you are the adult in the room. I can't tell you how that spoke to me, because I feel like that all the time when I'm looking. Who's the responsible person here? Oh, I'm the responsible person here. And also, no one ever tells you when you're young that when you get older, one of the biggest decisions you have to keep making is what you're going to eat. And who's, because you've got to think, I've got to make something. And it's too stressful for me. But I wish I was like my friend who eats out nearly every day. But I can't afford to do that. And I'm guessing nor can we. But I want to talk about the reality is life does get difficult. You see, we have difficult people to deal with. Obviously, none of you. Of course not. Difficult situations, difficult decisions to make, difficult problems to deal with, difficult relationships to handle. And what the author's trying to tell us, and the preacher here, is that it's in the difficult that actually we begin to learn. In these things that perhaps we struggle with, it's in those times that I hope it turns us more to face God and ask God for help in these things. Sadly, for some, it's the difficult that turns people away from God. But we can't avoid it. The difficult comes. And so the preacher is wanting us to consider the difficult things, to think differently about them and to find the value. Of course, we all want the pleasant. Of course, we all want to choose the good things. And if we had a choice, of course, we would rather enjoy the party than perhaps the funeral. But as we will see, it's in the difficult that we find something deeper. And that is the purpose of what he is talking about. And so we then begin to read in chapter 7 this collection of the difficult versus the pleasant. It's like a grudge match. It's like in the red corner you've got the difficult, in the blue corner you've got the pleasant stuff. And then there's this another little phrase that keeps coming out, is these two words, better than. One is better than the other. And so it starts, and I'm going to go fairly quickly, but we're going to go through almost verse by verse, because in each verse there's a different better than proverb. So it should be fairly easy to follow, I hope. And it starts off with name versus luxury. A good name is better than a fine perfume. In Israel, and actually still today in many parts of the world, a name isn't just a name. Oh, I'd love, if I had time, I need to tell you about my name, because you might think I'm just called Mark, but it is much more of a bigger story when God told me that my mum and dad weren't the only ones who named me Mark. God named me Mark for a reason, but I haven't got time to share that story. Sorry, it will come up in another sermon at some point. But name in Israel, it also meant nature. Name and nature were kind of expressively the same. It was about how your character was. And so when it's saying name here versus luxury, it's a good reputation that flows out of our character. A good name, a good nature, a good character is better than a luxury like fine perfume. What's inside is more important than the outer fragrance. In many ways, it's what is worth the most, a good name or a fine perfume. And if you're putting worth on it, then the preacher in Ecclesiastes is saying, well, actually, your name is worth way more than these things. And Jesus is so much more interested in who we are as opposed to what we have. He's so much more interested in our character than in the luxury of a fine perfume. Then it says this strange phrase, which is that the day of death is better than the day of birth. That is back to around thinking in for us. The honest truth is we don't remember our birth, do we? I hope none of you remember your birth. That would be, if your first ever memory was your birth, then wow. But we don't. We don't remember our birth. But I think we can agree that actually our birth, for those who were there, would have been, I guess, full of hope. An expectation of what this child might become and be. Everyone's happy at the birth of a child, usually, aren't they? It's usually a happy occasion. And so why on earth would the author say that actually the day of death is better than the day of birth? How on earth can the day of our death be worth more or better than the day of our birth? Well, he goes on in the next verse to give us a little bit of indication. He says, the funeral versus the party. Because death comes to us all, there is no avoiding it. And so the author's saying there's actually wisdom in at least embracing what we know will come to us all. There's wisdom in knowing the truth of death. And the reality with death, and I get to do a lot of funerals, is that it brings people to a point to consider what life is about. You don't tend to consider life in the same way at birth because it's your whole life is before you. But often when death comes, it stops people in their tracks. It stops the living in their tracks to think about life. Do you get me? I recently did a funeral for a family, three people who used to be my young people. I always say they used to be my young people because they're now all grown adults. But I did the funeral for their dad who died unexpectedly. And I had a message from the daughter Zoe just recently, well, like the day after. And this is part of the message that she sent me. She said, until I started working with you on the order of service, I hadn't appreciated a funeral could be anything more than a formality. The process you led us through was sensitive yet purposeful, unique to us, rooted in scriptures. Whilst it still hurts, I now see that there is a reason why he died.
You really helped me begin to deal with the reality of taking me through the process of the funeral with the words you spoke, which brought closure and hope. You see, in the midst of this girl's pain of the death of her father, she was beginning to process what life was about a bit more for her. And that's why the author is saying the day of our death is better than the day of our birth, because it helps us to look beyond and to what's going to happen next. For us as Christians, the day of death is not the end of it, is it? It's the beginning of our hope in heaven. That's why we need to take it to heart. Take it to the very thing that gives life, to understand death can enable us to actually live. We don't like thinking about it because it is sad and it is hard and it is difficult. But I hope that we can see the wisdom in it as well, that it will enable us to live now. Often somebody who's died who has been just a great example of how to live can really inspire us, can't it? Inspire us to be better people, to live better. And I think that's what the author's getting at here, that we've got to consider these things and take them to heart. And then in verse 3, he says that sorrow versus laughter. Different translations say different things. The NIV uses the word frustration is better than laughter. And again, the truth here is that actually being sometimes in a place of sorrow can teach us more than just being in a place of laughter. Now, don't hear me wrong. That's not to say we shouldn't laugh. Of course we should. But there's something deeper in the sorrow. And I think that's right. The New Living Translation uses the word that it can sort of influence us more. And then we come on to verse 4, and it says this is about mourning versus pleasure. There we are. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure. Again, there is wisdom when the reality of death hits us. The reality for many is that people live for the moment. They live for the now without any consideration of what's next. They're blind to anything of life above the sun. The reality of heaven is just not there for them. But they will be found out. And we don't want that for people. We don't want to be the doom mongers. Of course, we have good news. And the good news is that death has been beaten. Verse 5, rebuke versus songs. When someone we trust and love and respect, perhaps a mentor or just someone who we consider to be wise, when they speak into our lives, it does so much more for us. And sometimes when we allow people to speak into our lives, it might act as a rebuke. When I first started off in youth ministry, I was So pleased to be able to work in a town which had eight, it was only Bury St Edmunds, which is quite a small town, but there were eight other youth ministers in this one town, and all of them had been doing it much longer than me. And it was so great that I suddenly had these people who I could turn to. And one chap in particular, I didn't ask him to do it in an official capacity, but I did allow him to speak into my life. And there was one time where he rebuked me about something that I'd said. And I don't know what it was now. I think I'd said something a bit rude to somebody or something, and he picked me up on it. And do you know what? I said to him when he told me, I said, that's not true. And I went home in a really bad mood that my friend had said this to me. And actually, as I got home, by the time I'd got home, I realised, yeah, he was absolutely true. I shouldn't have said what I said. And I made a vow to myself at that point, I'm going to take what he says seriously. And I'm going to try to not say that anymore and to be better. You see, the rebuke hurt me, but I learned so much from it. It changed me as a person. And if we allow people, we have to allow people. We can't just go up to people, I believe, and say something. We have to know we have that relationship and allow people to speak into our lives. But a rebuke can help us to grow. And it's more visible than just a song which ultimately would fade away. That's kind of what the author's saying here. The song of a fool, it doesn't really mean anything. It's just words which will fade. Where a rebuke can change. And he uses this example of thorns sort of crackling in a pot, that it might make a lot of noise, but eventually it will die down because it's just meaningless. And then we come on to verse 7, which is a bit of a strange verse because it kind of sort of just sticks out a little bit. It doesn't seem to fit. Extortion turns a wise person into a fool, and a bribe corrupts the heart. And it's this idea of oppression and corruption, or extortion and corruption. And the point here is that sometimes even the wise have to watch themselves, because as soon as they give in to accepting or even being someone who is oppressive or extorting somebody, they can very quickly turn from someone wise into something foolish. Now we come on to verse 8. The end of a matter is better than its beginning. Who here would say that they are a starter of things? No starter. Who's a good finisher of things? Anyone good at finishing? What about books? Who here, when they read a book, will just read it all the way through, cover to finish? I will start a book and then it will slowly slow down, and I'm rubbish at finishing books. It has to be really good for me to finish it, otherwise I'll start reading something else and then that one's gone. Starting something is naturally, I think, a bit more exciting, isn't it? There's the buzz of something starting up. There's a sense of hope in it. But as always, the things which I think, oh, that's the best thing, the preacher seems to say, well, actually, the better than that is, it's not the beginning, it's the end has more value. The beginning might be immediate, it might be right now, there's no waiting for it, but the end takes patience and persistence. He sort of goes on into the next verse. In one sense, he's saying, well, don't be proud of what you've started, but be patient in seeing it through to the very end. And actually, it reminds me of 2 Timothy 4, where Paul says, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race, I have kept the faith. There's something about following Jesus, of consistently and patiently in the good times and in the hard times and in the difficult times, just following him, that we see it through to the end. And then he carries this thinking on into verse 9, where he talks about haste and anger. He says, do not be quickly provoked in your spirit, for anger resides in the lap of fools. Haste is the opposite of patience. And to be quick to get angry really is the way that a fool would work. We're obviously not talking about righteous anger here, which, God, we need more of it, to be honest. But he's saying, life under the sun, finish what you've started, be patient. The best way to live is not to be quick to get angry. And then this great phrase, which we all smiled at, do not say, why were the old days better than these? Now, let's be honest. We've all probably said it, haven't we? In some form or another, I'm all sure we've harked back to the good old days when everything was wonderful. Was it? Was that really the reality? I think we tend to look at things, don't we, through the rose-coloured spectacles, really. And perhaps at times the past was better. Certainly when we were younger, with less responsibility. And there may have been some value in that, but it's often the tough and the difficult where we grow more, as we started with. It's how we develop, and it's why it's so valuable, because it pushes us into deeper thinking. We search for God more, we lean on him, and we press into him more when things are hard. And to hark back to the good old days, that's not to say we can't learn from the past, because I think we can. But it's not always wise to think that the good old days are better than the now. And then just finally, we're nearly there. Verses 11 and 12 is wisdom versus money. Both wisdom and money can be beneficial. Of course they can. Some offer some protection. I always love the quote that the American comedian Richard Pryor said, and it wasn't part of his stand-up act. He'd been involved in a serious accident where he nearly died. And when talking about it in an interview, he said, at that moment, I didn't cry out to the Bank of New York. Money won't save your life, but perhaps wisdom could. And wisdom is more difficult to obtain. And then very finally, the last two verses that we're looking at this morning, prosperity versus adversity. Wisdom preserves those who have it. Consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked? Can I have the next one as well, please? When times are good, be happy. But when times are bad, consider this. God has made one as well as the other. Therefore, no one can discover anything about their future. It's pretty clear in there that in the good times, in the bad times, in the times when things are difficult, I mean, in the times when things are easy, God has made both of them. We can rejoice in the pleasant, but we need to push through to him in faith in the difficult. And if we believe that God is in control of life under the sun, then we have to learn to trust him. We don't know what lies ahead. It could be the great stuff. It could be the hard stuff. It could be the sorrow. It could be the joy. We just don't know. But what we do know is that Jesus will be with us in it all. That we can learn and grow from the hard and the difficult. Even if we don't want to, we can. And we have to lean on him in it all.